Hello, I'm Kirsty Young. Thank you for downloading this podcast of Desert Island Discs from BBC Radio 4. For rights reasons, the music choices are shorter than in the radio broadcast. For more information about the programme, please visit bbc.co.uk/radio4. My castaway this week is Nicola Sturgeon, Scotland's First Minister and leader of the SNP. She is that rare and fascinating animal, a politician admired even by many who strongly disagree with her politics. This year, she took her party to staggering success at the general election, all but wiping out the opposition by winning 56 of Scotland's 59 Westminster seats. Since she became party leader, the SNP's membership has quadrupled. Whether she's being huckled aside for yet another selfie on the streets or incisively marshalling her argument in the televised leaders' debates, it is her twin ability to appear both super smart and untypically straightforward that seems to connect with the electorate. Everything in her background points to an entirely ordinary 1970s west of Scotland upbringing. Dad an electrician, mum a dental nurse, days spent in a nice wee local school. But by the age of just 16, she'd forsaken the delights of Frosty's Ice Disco at the Irvine Magnum Centre to immerse herself in local politics, which, she admits, makes her sound like a really weird teenager. By the age of 21, she was the youngest candidate standing at the 1992 general election. She says, "I'm a child of the Thatcher years. I came into politics because of my desire for social justice and greater equality. My background, where I grew up, all of that has conditioned my perspective." So welcome, First Minister.
Thank you.
It has, of course, been quite a 12 months. We've had Scotland's historic independence vote in September last year. Of course, that vote was lost to you by 55% to 45%. You then took over unopposed as Alex Salmond's replacement. And then in May of this year, we had, as I said, your party's really stunning achievement of decimating Scottish Labour at the election. It seems like it's been a roller coaster from the outside. How has it been from the inside?
It's been a roller coaster from the inside as well. I came out of the 18th of September totally and utterly devastated. I'd given my heart and soul, as had many other people, to trying to win a yes vote. We'd come very close, closer than many people thought we might. So I was devastated and floods of tears. And as that was all happening, Alex Salmond told me he was going to step down as party leader the day after the referendum, and there was no change in his mind. I actually tried very hard to change his mind. So suddenly, out of that exhaustion and devastation, I just saw my entire life change before me.
So that's the low of the roller coaster. Let's go to one of the highs, well, the high, really, which, of course, was the general election in May. David Cameron said that he allowed himself a short nap on the morning of the 8th of May, and he said he woke up and thought he'd died and gone to heaven. So how was it for you?
I didn't get a nap. I got a flight down to London, actually, for the VE Day celebration. So I knew I was going to see David Cameron, Ed Miliband, Nick Clegg. So there was a sort of surreal element to all of that. But, you know, it was euphoria. I mean, I've campaigned for the SNP all of my adult life, and at times, many times over these years, it seemed as if defeating Labour in a Westminster election in their heartlands was just the impossible task. So for suddenly that to happen, it was a huge moment of euphoria.
There increasingly seemed to be quite a few areas of policy that seemed to unite you with Jeremy Corbyn's Labour Party, you know, thinking of things like anti-austerity, anti-Trident and so on and so on. Is Jeremy Corbyn somebody you admire? Do you admire his politics? Do you think he would make a good prime minister?
I've never met Jeremy Corbyn. I'm sure that will change in the not too distant future. So I don't feel able to kind of judge him on a personal basis or judge his character. The doubt I have about Jeremy Corbyn's leadership of the Labour Party is about his ability to take the Labour Party with him. And there's not going to be perhaps too much benefit to anybody in having the leader of a Labour Party who, you know, for example, is against Trident, if the rest of the party is for that. But, you know, I'm open to working with them on issues where we've got common ground.
Now, Nicola Sturgeon, you are, of course, a veteran of the political interview, and today you're hopefully going to be talking not just a little bit of politics, but I want to ask you a lot about yourself. I mean, I'm presuming this is your list. You know,
this
there's always that speculation
for
with a politician.
For better or worse, this is all me. And some of it, as you can probably guess which ones, I might take some time to live down when I get back home to Scotland.
Let's hear your first piece of music then, Nicola Sturgeon. Tell me about this. Yes, here we go.
Well, this is... I had a childhood obsession with the wonderful Cilla Black. She was probably the cause of my first, probably not my first ever tantrum, the first ever tantrum I remember as a child when I stood in Littlewoods demanding to get her album bought for me, and my mum and dad said no, and my wonderful granddad came along and rode to the rescue and bought it for me. So this is Cilla Black, Step Inside Love.
Step inside love, let me find you a place where the cares of the day will be carried away by the smile on your face. We are together now and forever. Come my way. Step inside love and stay. Step inside love. Step inside love.
That was Cilla Black and Step Inside Love. A wry laugh you're allowing yourself, Nicola Sturgeon.
She was wonderful.
So David Cameron then has, as we all know, promised this in-out referendum on Europe before the end of 2017. You have said to date, as I understand it, that if the UK as a whole votes to come out of Europe, but Scotland votes as a country to stay in Europe, that would trigger another independence referendum, that it would really, in essence, be unstoppable under those circumstances. And I'm wondering what happened to last year's promise that the independence referendum was going to be, as both you and Alex Salmond said, a once-in-a-generation opportunity.
Well, I said it could make a referendum unstoppable. The once-in-a-generation, once-in-a-lifetime, if that's what people in Scotland want the independence referendum to be, that's exactly what it will be. You know, if we remember back to the independence referendum, many people in the No campaign tried to persuade people in Scotland to vote no on the basis that that was the only way to guarantee our membership of the European Union. So if we find that membership jeopardised now, I just think there will be a groundswell of opinion in Scotland that says we should look at the independence question again. But I hasten to add, I hope that doesn't happen. I will be making the case for Scotland and the UK as a whole to vote to stay in the European Union. So in a sense, I hope the scenario that I'm describing doesn't arise.
But just to be clear, if there is a very straight, delineated vote around about Scotland that says, yes, we the Scottish want to stay in and we are different from the rest of the UK in that they voted to go out, are you saying that you will petition David Cameron for a second vote on independence?
I think we'd need to see what the opinion was around the time. What I'm saying at this
what
stage
is... What do
you mean,
the opinion polls or political opinion?
I may get it wrong. Maybe people wouldn't have the groundswell of opinion. I just happen to think that there would be that groundswell of opinion. So I think in those circumstances, I think there would be a significant body of opinion in Scotland that was clamouring and asking me to bring forward another referendum.
Your predecessor, I think, would have said, in fact, Alex Salmond has very recently said that it's as near as inevitable as anything can be in politics that would trigger that.
I think Scotland will become an independent country. I've believed that for a long time. I probably believe it more now than I did before the referendum. But what I'm saying is that it won't happen just because I want it to happen. And there's a definite sense in Scotland that the big decisions are for the people, not for politicians alone to take.
There is a thread of the pragmatic, consensual politician that
seems to
run through you. And I wonder, under those circumstances, what do you make of those people in the other parts of the United Kingdom who felt very strongly and very dearly that they really didn't want Scotland to leave? What would you say to comfort them?
Well, two things. Firstly, I respect that and always have respected that. And secondly, if there was one thing that did upset me often during the referendum campaign was when I came up against people who lived in England who felt that what Scotland was doing represented in some way a rejection, that it showed some kind of antipathy or hostility towards England. That genuinely upset me because nothing could be further from what I believe in. You know, my grandmother was English and she was a big nationalist. She was an SNP supporter. My childhood wasn't full of politics. But I suppose she's one of the reasons why my nationalism has never really been about identity or driven by a belief that you've got to be purebred Scots to support independence for Scotland, because she came from just outside Sunderland in the north of England and yet had this kind of belief that Scotland should be an independent country. So I detested that sense that somehow what we were arguing for was a rejection of England as a country or England as a people.
Let's hear your second piece of music, First Minister. What is it?
This is Freedom Come All Ye, which is a famous Scottish protest song, anti-imperialist song. This version of it was performed by Pumeza, a South African singer, at the opening ceremony of the Commonwealth Games. And this is one of my favourite versions of a beautiful song.
Was Pumeza Machikeza and Freedom Come All Ye. So, Nicola Sturgeon, as I mentioned, your father, Robin, was an electrician. Mm-hmm. Your mother, at the time they married, I think, was a dental nurse. Mm-hmm. They were very young when they
very
married.
Very young.
Your mother was 17, your father 21. What are your very early memories of home life?
My memories of home life are just of stability, security. My mum and dad were my world when I was wee. You know, if I look back now, and think about what my mum and dad instilled in me, it's nothing short of remarkable in some ways, because, as you say, they were really young when I was born. I guess their own life experiences at that time must have been fairly limited. Nobody in either of their families had ever gone to university. They probably hadn't come across that many people that had gone to university, and yet they managed to raise this wee girl who, from as far back as I can remember, had a belief that aspiring to go to university was something that I should take for granted.
Was that explicit? Did your mum sort of sit on your knee and say, Nicola, you're a smart wee girl?
I guess that's what I kind of marvel about when I look back on it, because it was an unspoken look. You know, you can do what you want. Don't let people tell you that because of your gender or your background or your family that you're not able to go on and achieve what it is your heart wants you to achieve. And I never doubted that.
It was a peculiarly political time that you found yourself growing up in. You know, the 1980s was a time of course, Thatcher's government. People in Scotland were finding that Westminster in no way reflected the votes that they were putting in the ballot box. And it was the time of the poll tax being introduced first to Scotland. It was the time of the miners' strike. There was Ravenscraig Steelworks being wound down and eventually closed. Did you find yourself, as a youngster in those early teenage years, connecting with politics as a reality that was impactful upon people's lives?
Absolutely. I mean, for me, my political awakening, if I can be as grand as to call it that, was all about what was happening around me. It wasn't some romantic, patriotic, you know, vision of Scotland going back to what it had been 300 years previously. It was very much about a sense of hopelessness in the community I was growing up in.
Did you see that firsthand?
Yeah, I did. I was surrounded. You know, I guess if you ask me the kind of feelings I remember from that time, I remember a feeling that I had and all my friends had. If your dad back then was made redundant or lost his job, then there was a sense that that would be terminal, that he might never work again. People I went to school with, and, you know, the school I went to, it wasn't commonplace to go on to further education or higher education. If you weren't doing that, there was a sense that you might, you know, end up without a job, without any real hope for the future. And that all created this sense of hopelessness, as it seemed to me back then, being inflicted by a government that most people in Scotland hadn't voted for and would never have voted for. And that's what provoked me into politics and sparked the political interest that has stayed with me ever since.
Tell me about your third piece of music.
Oh, my third piece of music is Duran Duran. I am, notwithstanding all of this political chat, just an 80s girl at heart. So Duran Duran, Wham, all of these groups were the soundtrack to my teenage years. This is actually a later Duran Duran song, Ordinary World, which I think if I had to choose out of many classic Duran Duran tracks, this would be my all-time favourite. What has happened to it all? Crazy summer sand. But I won't cry for yesterday. There's an ordinary world. Somehow I
That was Duran Duran and Ordinary World, and I should tell the world that just as we were coming to the end of that, First Minister Nicola Sturgeon said, I got a tweet from Simon Le Bon a few months ago. Tell me more about that, First Minister.
Well, he'd read somewhere that I was a Duran Duran fan. I think I'd been talking in an interview about going to the Barrowlands, the famous Barrowlands in Glasgow, to see them. So he tweeted me something along the lines of, I always thought you had good sense. But I thought to myself, if I'd been able to go back in time and tell my 14-year-old self that one day Simon Le Bon would get in touch with me, I think she'd have fainted.
Let's talk for a moment about Frosty's Ice Disco at the Magnum Centre. Well, you know what? There are very few opportunities for me to raise this on Desert Island Disc, so I may as well make the best of it. The Ice Disco. So you would get, what, the crimpers out and the eyeliner and head down to Frosty's,
would
you?
We are clearly of the same vintage, Kirsty, yes. It was kind of day-glow yellow and nice. And orange and sort of pink leg warmers and things that you would wear in those days. But yeah, the Magnum was probably the first of its kind in these big leisure centres in Irvine where I grew up. But the ice rink had a Saturday night disco called Frosty's, where we just used to skate round and round and round and round to the sound of Wham and Duran Duran and Culture Club and all sorts of delights like that.
So this, you'd be what, about 14, 15?
I'd be 14, 15, yeah. There was a slight overlap, I think, between Frosty's and my political awakening.
And, you know, all teenagers, it might be fair to say, like a tribe, you know, we decide, and that might be we define ourselves through the music we like or the clothes that we might wear as teenagers. Why was politics your tribe? What was it about that?
I was fascinated by it. I was fascinated long before I joined the SNP. I was fascinated in the world around me. Current affairs really interested me, and not just Scottish current affairs. I was interested in what was happening in South Africa and Palestine and other parts of the world. I had a modern studies teacher who really encouraged that and who taught me to test and challenge my own opinions, which was probably one of the most valuable things that he did for me.
What about, I mean, the great looming figure of her time then, of course, was Margaret Thatcher. I have to tell listeners that you're sitting here today in a beautiful royal blue, exquisitely cut suit that
probably
the lady
shouldn't
herself
tell,
would have been proud of.
I can't believe I'm about to tell the listening public this, because no doubt I'll get slated for it, but I'm also reading the Charles Moore biography of Mrs. Thatcher at the moment. I'm interested in the whole kind of art and science of decision making.
One of the things she did do, of course, was introduce the right to buy for council house tenants. As I understand it, your parents took advantage of that and bought their own council house. And as I also understand it, that is a right that you intend to withdraw from people now in Scotland. Do you not think that is rather pulling the ladder away from aspirational families who might want to do the same as your parents wanted to
do? Yeah, I mean, I understand that argument, but we live in a very different time now. There's enormous pressure on social housing, affordable housing for people to rent. And when there is so much pressure on it, and when we're having to, as we are, find money to build more social housing, it seems to me that in this particular time, it's not right to then let that be sold off. But what I would also say is we do lots in other ways to help people into home ownership. So we've got, you know, help to buy schemes. So it's not about closing off the aspiration to home ownership, which is a good aspiration that I think it's right to support. It's just we do it in different ways.
Let's have some more music, Nicola Sturgeon. Oh.
Well, this is The Proclaimers, two guys I know and fantastic guys, Letter from America, which probably was the soundtrack to my political awakening, but also mentions my hometown, which was always a big thing back then.
When you go, will you send back a letter?
That was The Proclaimers and Letter from America. So Nicola Sturgeon, Mari Black, the SNP MP, the youngest elected politician in Britain, aged just 20. There are some parallels. You stood at 21, 1992 general election, I think it was. During that election, you were the youngest candidate standing. There wasn't a chance of you winning it. You knew that, of course. You graduated then in 1992. You got 2-1 in law. You went on to practice law, was a solicitor's in Stirling, where you did matrimonial, you did criminal cases. What did you learn about people and life and the difficulties that people go through as you were a young lawyer?
I learned a lot, both there and probably more so in the next legal job I did, which was in a law centre in Drumchapel in Glasgow.
Which is a very underprivileged part of Scotland.
Absolutely. Yes. So, you know, I learned very directly the kind of issues and problems and challenges people come up against in their everyday lives. And that probably, more than anything, equipped me for the job of being a member of Parliament.
Never then a sense of overwhelm as you sat there listening to people who were saying, well, I mean, he's not getting to see my wains because such and such. You're thinking, I can't solve this.
Totally. And, you know, I feel that regularly to this day sometimes. You know, I'm First Minister of Scotland, but I still will regularly feel overwhelmed by some of the things I'm dealing with, and probably never more so than sitting in a constituency surgery with somebody at their wit's end because of a benefits problem, or a problem with dampness in their housing, or an abusive partner that's threatening to take away their kids, and knowing that you'll do everything you can to help them, but you might not actually be able to solve the problem. That's one of the most dispiriting parts of being a politician, and it was certainly true of being a lawyer all those years ago.
So where do you go with that when you have the overwhelm? Who do you discuss it with? Is it with your husband?
Yeah, I mean, principally it'll be with Peter, my husband. I mean, he bears the brunt of most of it. I'm quite hot-headed, I'm quite impulsive. You know, it doesn't last very long, thankfully, but if I'm confronted with a big problem, I go, oh my goodness, what am I going to do about it? Where he's very calm and doesn't get flustered very easily, and that is exactly what I need in my life, particularly just now.
So Peter is Peter Murrell, who is the chief executive of the SNP. Why did you fall for him?
We knew each other long before we ended up getting together. We worked together particularly closely in a campaign, and then when the campaign ended and there was no real reason for us to see each other every day the way we had done for the last 3 months, I suddenly realised I wanted to see him every day, and luckily he felt the same.
You don't have children, and that has been used by some of your political opponents as an implicit criticism.
Yeah.
What do you make of that?
That can be hurtful, if I'm being brutally honest about it, because people make assumptions about why we don't have children. And frankly, people who make those assumptions know nothing of the reality of that. And the assumption that people sometimes, not everybody, but the assumption that people sometimes make is that I have made a cold, calculated decision to put my career ahead of having a family. And that's not true. It never has been true. You know, sometimes things happen in life, sometimes they don't. Don't get me wrong, I have no regrets. And if I could turn the clock back 10, 20 years, I wouldn't want to fundamentally change the path that my life has taken. But it's just the way in which people just assume that it's all part of this kind of cold, calculating, career-driven woman. And actually, I think for most women, that couldn't be further from the truth, even if they have got very successful in their careers and haven't had children.
Do you and Peter have a rule? Is there a no politics night at home?
We try. And actually, it's not as hard as people might think it is, because, you know, that will usually be a Friday night or a Saturday night when we're both exhausted and, you know, all we really want to do is sit in front of the television with a glass of wine and then fall asleep.
Right, time for some more music then, Nicola Sturgeon. Tell me about this disc.
Well, this is My Love is Like a Red, Red Rose, famous Robert Burns song, beautifully sung by Eddie Reader. But this is special to me, partly because I love Robert Burns, but also because this is the song that was played just before Peter and I took our vows at our wedding.
My love is like a red, red rose. It's newly sprung in June. My heart is like a melody that sweetly plays its tune. This fair art thou, my bonny lad, so deep in love.
Eddie Reader singing Robert Burns' My Love is Like a Red, Red Rose. So, Nicola Sturgeon, you stood for election, is this right, 7 times?
Yeah,
unsuccessfully.
So.
In the first past the post system.
I try not to count it.
Before you won a seat, yeah. You became a member of the Scottish Parliament in 1999, following devolution, of course. You were Alex Salmond's deputy for 10 years. I think your powers of endurance are remarkable.
Yeah, I wouldn't disagree with that for a second. You know, I'm a great believer, actually, that although I'm sure at the time it didn't feel like, I know at the time it didn't feel like this, but all those defeats along the way, actually were good for me, because I think they helped me build up resilience and learn what it was you needed to do to win. So I don't regret any of that.
Nippy sweetie Nicola Nippy sweetie. The most dangerous woman in Britain are two of the epithets that have been hung around your neck. Anyone who saw you go hammer and tongs at George Galloway in the big, big debate the night before the independence vote would be clear that, well, would you say you're somebody who enjoys a good Barney?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. There's no doubt about it. And I guess now that I'm First Minister and very conscious of the responsibilities I have as First Minister, not just to be a partisan politician, of course I am that, but to be more than that, to represent people regardless of their political views, I suppose I feel more of a responsibility now on occasion to hold that part of myself in check. I don't always find it easy. But yeah, I mean, I don't think you can be a politician without having that ability and that desire to stand up and fight for what it is you believe in.
You voiced annoyance about the amount of commentary there's been over in recent times about your appearance and your style and how it's changed. And yet, very recently, you chose to appear in a seven-page spread in Vogue magazine.
What can I say? You know, I don't mind saying I struggle a little bit with this because on the one hand, I want politics to be accessible. But I'm equally of the view that there is too much focus on what women wear, what their hair looks like. And that would be fine if it applied to men as well. So, yeah, I'm under no illusions that sometimes I might appear to be and feel myself to be a wee bit conflicted and contradictory on that.
Let's have some more music, Nicola Sturgeon. Tell me about your sixth.
The wonderful voice of Kate Bush, Wuthering Heights, which is a fantastic. So I love Kate Bush and I love this song. But Wuthering Heights was also, when I was a teenager, one of my favourite books. So I used to play this incessantly while reading Emily Bronte.
Kate Bush and Wuthering Heights. So, Nicola Sturgeon, there was very recently a truly tragic state of affairs in Scotland. You will be more than familiar with the details, but I should maybe remind listeners there was a car crash, there was a reported crash, and there were deaths. Police Scotland is being scrutinised and criticised like never before. The single force, the shine has come off the idea. If that had happened in British politics, the Home Secretary would probably have had to resign. Has enough been done to acknowledge the state of affairs within Scottish policing right now?
I should say that particular incident, which was appalling and tragic, and you know, my heart still every day goes out to the families of these two people. It's still under investigation, so I'm to some extent limited in what I can say about that. But you know, whatever lessons have to be learned about the circumstances of that, there is an absolute determination that they will be learned. I believe the move to the single police force was the right thing to do. You know, at a time when money is as horrendously tight as it is just now, having eight chief constables in a country the size of Scotland, I don't think it's a good use of money. So I think that was right. I try not to be, I'm sure I don't always succeed, but I try not to be defensive when things go wrong. You often can't undo what's been done, but you can learn lessons and make sure that you minimise the chances of it happening again.
There is an acknowledgement among many people who have held office at the very highest level that it can be a very lonely place to be. What's your view on that?
I absolutely agree with that. And I guess the most eye-opening thing about my experience of the last 12 months is just how true that old cliché is. I mean, I guess you've commented previously on the fact that I'd been Alex Salmond's deputy for 10 years. I guess I went into the job thinking I'd been so close to it for so long that I knew all there was to know about it. And you quickly find out that that's not true, that nothing quite prepares you for that moment when you've got to take the first big decision. And I vividly remember that. I don't actually remember what the decision was, but I remember that feeling in my stomach when I realised that it was quite a difficult decision and I was having to take it and the guy next door wasn't there anymore to pass it over to. And that was a revelation at that point. I think I've got and have developed over the years a kind of resilience and an inner strength and a sort of ability to stand up against the critics. And I found that while in the moment it can be difficult, it's certainly lonely, I, in a strange sort of way, also feel quite comfortable with decision making, and I'm prepared to live with the consequences. So, you know, there's something in me that, you know, has managed to convince myself I've got what it takes to be a leader.
Let's have some more music, Nicola Sturgeon. It is time for your seventh. Well, the message is clear. Tell me about this.
Sisters are doing it for themselves, Eurythmics and the wonderful Aretha Franklin. Gender issues matter a lot to me. I'm the first woman to hold the job as First Minister, so this is a song that speaks to the feminist in me.
The Eurythmics and Aretha Franklin and Sisters are doing it for themselves. You are not, then, by your own admission, a naturally gregarious person. Is there a sense in which, you know, before you go out there as First Minister, you sort of have to gird yourself and put Nicola Sturgeon on, as it were?
Less so now, I think. But in the early days of my career, that was definitely an issue. I think that I would sort of don the persona of Nicola the politician, and that's how I overcame the shyness. As I've got older, that sort of divide between the real me and the politician me has definitely disappeared. So what you see now is the real me, for better or worse.
I'm about to cast you away, Nicola Sturgeon, to this island. Now, you know, without Twitter, without the advisers, without your husband yesterday, you've come across today, and indeed at other times, as a great pragmatist, but maybe not very practical.
I'm not practical in the slightest. Luckily, Peter is. He's a great cook.
So on the island, I'm thinking.
I won't survive a week. So, you know, this is what I take with me and everything. It's pretty academic because I won't survive for very long.
Let's then go to your final disc. Tell me about this.
Well, this is, you know, the ultimate upbeat, optimistic, motivational song. I absolutely love it. If I'm feeling down, if it's all getting on top of me, a blast of this cheers me up. Labi Siffra, Something Inside So Strong.
No matter, cause there's something inside so strong. I know that I can make it, though you're doing me wrong, so wrong. You thought that my pride was gone, oh no. Something inside so strong, oh, something inside so strong.
Labi Siffra and Something Inside So Strong. It's time now then, Nicola Sturgeon, for me to cast you away. I'm going to give you the books. I give everybody the Bible and the complete works of Shakespeare. What's the other book you're going to take to the island?
I'm going to take the complete works of Jane Austen.
And a luxury too, of course. What's your luxury going to be?
I'm going to take a coffee machine, because the one thing I cannot do without in the morning is my injection of caffeine.
How do you like it? Do you like it strong?
I like it strong.
Okay.
With a little bit of milk.
Okay.
Do I get milk on the desert?
Yes, we'll give you that. We'll give you the full complement for the perfect cup of coffee every morning, even a cup to put it in. And finally, if I were to ask you to pick just one of the eight to save, which one would it be?
Oh, it would be My Love Is Like a Red, Red Rose.
Nicola Sturgeon, First Minister of Scotland, thank you very much for letting us hear your Desert Island Discs.
Thank you.
You've been listening to a download from the BBC. You'll find more information on the Radio 4 website, bbc.co.uk/radio4.